Soll schon kommen die Gehule, soll schon kommen die Gehule, soll schon kommen die Gehule, Mashiach komm schon bald.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
This season of Here I Am with Shai Davidai is dedicated to the memory of my grandmother, Savta Leah Davidai, who passed away earlier this year. Here I am with Savta Leah in mind.
So before we begin, I want to thank our Patreon supporters who are supporting the show and are watching the recording live on YouTube, special for Patreon supporters. My guest today is an actress, a singer, host of Mom Curious. She was born in the same hospital that my daughter was born.
Mount Sinai?
Yes.
Oh, nice.
And I have known her for quite a while because when our kids were, our older sons were 2-year-olds.
Maybe even younger.
Yeah. Were in the same Saturday or Sunday Hebrew singing class together with Yonatan.
Yonatan, man, where is he?
My daughter goes to his class.
Still, I would go. He's like a really awesome
musician. So let me introduce you.
Oh, sorry. Hi.
Here I am with Daniela Rabbani.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for the work you're doing. Thanks for being such a great friend and amazing father. Since the moment I met you and Yarden and your kids, you've really been such a light.
It's same here. And I still remember when you first came to our house. Back when we lived in our previous apartment. But this is not about me. This is about you. Daniela Rabbani, I'm going to start with the same question I ask everyone when we begin. What kind of a Jew are you?
Okay, so I've had a lot of time to consider this question, not only because I'm 40 years old, but also because I'm a fan of this podcast, so I knew you were going to ask. I usually refer to myself as the biggest Jew you know, but I'll break it down for you because I'm an American Jew, I'm an Israeli Jew, I'm a Persian Jew, I'm a third-generation Holocaust-surviving Jew, I'm a traditional Jew, I'm a secular Jew, I'm an outspoken Jew, I'm a feminist Jew, I'm a liberal Jew.
You were raised Modern Orthodox.
I was raised Modern Orthodox. Biggest Jew you know still stands.
What does that mean, biggest Jew?
I guess it's because I'm so proud to be Jewish. I'm proud to be curious about my Judaism. I'm proud to be alive and to exist as a Jew in this world. Hineni, here I am. You know, that's a miracle. And I don't take that for granted. I talk about it all the time. and I draw a lot of inspiration from being Jewish.
And I think there's something that a lot of Jewish, especially Jews in America, in the United States, in Canada, but also around diaspora, have experienced this resurgence of her Jewish identity. I think that does not count for you.
No,
so
I've
for
always...
you, this was not a post-October 7 Jewishness. Like the moment I've met you, you're not a Bagel and Lox Jew. You're
no.
So, as a child, were you this kind of Jew?
Well, I was raised Orthodox to Israeli parents, and they raised me with my father. Have you met my father?
I have.
Oh my God, what a big Jew! No, biggest Jew. And he's so proud of it. He's so proud of where he comes from. He was born and raised in Jerusalem, in Geula. He was the only Sephardic family on the block.
In Geula, so in Mea Shearim.
Mea Shearim, like in the ultra-Orthodox part of Jerusalem, steps away from the Kotel. And he loves Judaism as a religion, so he would really instill that in us. I, as an adult, don't practice the same way, but I have a deep reverence for the philosophy, for the literary culture. I just think there's still so much to learn about being Jewish, and I spent years in yeshiva, you know, studying. So I find that fascinating. But when I was younger, I don't know that I was so big into being Jewish. I was different. I was an artist. I was a rebel. I was the youngest of 3 kids. My brother served in the IDF, and my sister, they both made Aliyah when they were, you know, going to college, but they were significantly older than me. So I always had a foot in in Israel, but I never lived there. I don't know if I always felt so proud, but I also wasn't always in the secular world. So I find my experience to be somewhat of an ambassador in a way. Part of the reason why I'm like the biggest Jew you know is because you know me, because I expose myself to people who are not Jewish.
I want to talk about that because you are in a very interesting position where a lot of non-Jews get exposed to your content, and we'll get to that.
Okay.
But before that, tell me about the transition. So you're born or you're raised modern Orthodox, but you live a mostly secular life.
Yeah.
Was there a loss of faith? What happened there?
I was Orthodox until I think I was 21, 22. Like I went to NYU and kept Shabbat even as I was training to be an actor. Like I would leave early on Friday afternoons and miss class if I needed to miss class. When I studied Commedia dell'arte in Florence, Italy, I fasted, you know, in the summer and didn't go to Cinque Terre when they like went to see the masks. I was devout. I really took it seriously. And then I met Dan, who you know very well. He's my husband. And I found an atheist Jew who was just as proud to be Jewish as the rest of us, you know. But he was good. There was goodness in him that had nothing to do with the laws he sort of practiced. And I blame him. for everything. In case you're wondering, I blame him for everything.
Your parents probably blame him.
Yeah, but he's so Zeus. He's such a sweet, good man. I think they blame him in the most loving way. Yeah.
What was it like going to such a secular place, not just NYU, but NYU Tisch?
Yeah.
Right, which is like the most progressive performing arts, you know, in the most progressive city in the world. And yet you were there as the observant Jew.
Yeah. I was part of a very large cohort of Jewish kids, religious kids. We called it NY Jew. We lived at Weinstein. There were many of us from my yeshiva high school and from surrounding schools. So there were a lot of practicing Jews. There was a kosher dining hall. The kids who did really well went to great schools, just like NYU, just like Columbia. Mm-hmm. There was an anti-religious sentiment. I look back on it and I realize the religion was Judaism. I didn't know that at the time. And, you know, there was a time where I remember in sophomore year, I threw a party and there was a very angry guest of ours who, I guess he got drunk. I'm not sure what happened, but he went off on Israel and driving the Jews into the sea. And I was genuinely just confused. Like I didn't have enough of an education to hold that with any reverence. I was just like, what was that about? Really, I genuinely didn't know. When I was at NYU in London, I remember going to you know, a class trip to Bath. And similarly, there were these sort of neo-Nazi feeling guys who went off on the Jews. And I just went, I wonder what that is. I was so naive. I was also 17 when I went to college. I was like, you know, 20, 21 when I graduated. I was young and I didn't know. But when I went to Stella Adler, which is where I studied acting, you could still see it at the Stella Adler studio. There's a huge poster of Stella and her brother Luther, and there are Hebrew letters, you know, like telling the audience that they would be performing. It was like a poster. Mm-hmm. And those Hebrew letters weren't in Hebrew. It was writing Yiddish. And it turns out that Stella Adler was raised on the Yiddish stage. She later grew up to be Marlon Brando's acting teacher, but her studio still had memorabilia from the time when she, her brother, and her father, who was a tremendous star of the Yiddish stage, acted in the Yiddish theater. And I made my way through that actor training, mostly Shakespeare, Chekhov, like really rigorous beautiful, beautiful training. And when I was in my senior year, I played Hermia in A Midsummer Night's Dream, and Stella's grandson directed me in the show. And he takes me aside and he says, "You act like my family. Would you carry on the legacy of the Yiddish theater?" And so it's thanks to him, and it's thanks to NYU that I even do Yiddish theater, that I studied Yiddish, that I sing Yiddish.
Were you planning to?
No, I didn't even know it was a thing. I didn't know that there was a Yiddish theater ever. Even my Yiddish speaking grandparents didn't care to carry on that legacy. It was like a very American tradition that the Yiddish theater turned into off-Broadway, then Broadway, and now what we understand Hollywood to be. And Tom Oppenheim, who is Stella Adler's grandson, knew that. And he knew that there weren't many people who were going to take on this mantle. And by the way, the Yiddish theater was Shomer Shabbos. They still don't perform on Shabbat. So it was the perfect fit for me. And I attribute so much of my success, first of all, to the Yiddish theater, but also to Tom Oppenheim and Stella Adler and NYU for all its anti-religious, meaning anti-Jewish sentiments that it had. Kulo, you know.
Yeah, things work in mysterious ways sometimes. But explain to me how, like, a 21-year-old who's never thought about, you know, performing, speaking in Yiddish, how do you react when someone comes and say, "Hey, you should do Yiddish theater"? It's like, you're 21. You wanted to be in movies, in TV, on stage.
It's really interesting to me that most people would say, like, don't pigeonhole yourself. Like, don't tell people you're Jewish in Hollywood, because it never dawned on me. Like, when Tom said that to me, I only took it as a compliment. I only thought, oh my God, he thinks I act like Stella Adler? Hello. And he thinks that my Jewishness is sweet and funny and smart. And I never thought of it as anything other than, first of all, a job, but also an honor. I never hid my Judaism professionally, because I don't find it to be a problem. I also don't find it to be like at odds with being in movies, or I was the voice of Colgate for like 6 years. Like, I don't see how my Jewishness could ever, you know, be at odds with that work, you know?
Well, you have very bright white teeth. So
thank you. They're veneers.
So you get this moment of, sounds like an epiphany, of here's the direction that I didn't even know I was looking for, and someone's pointing me in that direction. What do you do next? Did you speak Yiddish at the time?
I did not speak any Yiddish. I went to the Workers' Circle, which still exists. It was the Workmen's Circle at the time, actually. It's now called the Workers' Circle. And I took lessons. You know, I studied Yiddish. I got a scholarship to study Yiddish through the National Yiddish Theater and through the Stella Adler Studio. Me and my friend Rabbi Rebecca Karen Eisenstadt, Jablonski now, she's no longer an actress, but we both took Yiddish lessons there. And I felt like when I was learning Yiddish that I was being reminded of something that I, or my soul, had remembered. Like, it felt like, oh yeah, that's how you say that word, or that's how you sing that song. I remember now.
Huh.
Having never really heard those words or those songs ever before, it was a really spiritual experience.
So interesting, because for as long as I remember knowing about Yiddish, it's always been described as a language that's dying and a language that's being revitalized.
At the same time.
I remember when I was in sixth grade, I didn't enroll, but we had it after school, Yiddish classes. It was like, now it's being reborn, resurging again. What is the magic? Why does Yiddish refuse to die?
Mm. It's amazing that it refuses to die, similar to the Jewish people. We are a literary people. there's a song called Oifen Pripichik, which teaches the Aleph base to the next generation. And it really exemplifies our reverence and love of language. Every single one of our Jewish languages, not just Yiddish, you know, Judeo-Arabic, Ladino, it's all based in Hebrew. And we refer to Hebrew as Lashon Kodesh, which means Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language. We Jewish people believe that language itself is holy. Abracadabra, right? That we can speak things into existence. You know,
explain that to people. I know what you mean, but I don't think the audience knows what you mean when you mentioned abracadabra.
So how do you say it in Hebrew?
I mean, abracadabra, but I think it's
abracadabra.
Yeah.
So it says in like the book of Genesis that God spoke and creation appeared. If you talk to any, you know, spiritualist, you know, any new age person, anyone who believes in manifesting, which is very, very like of the zeitgeist right now, they will tell you to, first of all, envision the thing you want and then speak it into being. That is a Jewish concept. In fact, I think it's Houdini would say abracadabra, meaning I make this into being. Here's the magic. We believe in the sanctity and the holiness of language itself. And so all of those Yiddishists would chronicle their life and their dreams and some things that we would consider to be like maybe even a little embarrassing. I.B. Singer would write about like whores and gamblers and the underworld. He would also talk about Kabbalah. These are like great literary minds, and they wrote in Yiddish. And it was such a precious language that Jews would be able to speak cross borders all over Eastern Europe, which just leads me to tell you that we got to talk to each other, even if we don't live in the same place, even if we don't believe the same things. Jews talk to each other. But it was so important to them to keep this language going that they would write songs and poems in the Holocaust and then publish them. And who are they publishing them for?
For themselves.
For you. Because we have an understanding of the next generation. The dor vador. Like, they were writing for their children and grandchildren to understand what it means to be a Yid. They said, Mir Zayin in Do. Do you know what that means? We are here. That's what the Yiddishists would say. Those who survived the Holocaust, there's this, the anthem called Zognitz Kainmol, which means never say. The anthem ends with Mir Zayin in Do. Never say you've gone your last way. One day, even though the skies have been blackened, there will be blue again.
That is so interesting because I think I know the song in Hebrew.
How does it go?
Al na tomar en zo darkei achrona. Don't ever say this is my last. It's the song of the partisans.
The partisans. And at the end they say, Mir zayin in do, hineni, here I am. My existence in and of itself is an act of resistance. They did say, by the way, Siznit kein Liedl von a Vogel after frei. It's not a song written by a free bird. It's a song written mit naganas in die Hand. It's a song now written with weapons in our hand. It was a turning point that the partisans had concretized in this song. And by the way, the writer died at 22, but his work lives on. They say, we will not go like sheep to the slaughter. We will defend ourselves.
So how did your grandparents react when you started speaking Yiddish?
My grandfather, Alav HaShalom, had already passed, but I do feel like I had a real line of communication with him in a way that I never had when he was alive, because he really only spoke Yiddish. I mean, he moved moved. He ended up in Israel, where my mother was born after the Holocaust, and he couldn't figure out Hebrew. But my grandmother was a linguist, so she spoke German and Romanian and Russian and Yiddish and Hebrew and English very well. He could not. He spoke Yiddish. He was a shtetl Jew. My grandmother, who was like so hoity-toity, I mean, these are her earrings, she was sort of embarrassed.
Embarrassed by?
Yiddish. She thought that is the sound of the poor Jew, the shtetl Jew, the victim Jew, not so dissimilar to the way many people regard Yiddish today. You know, we created a new Jew. Part of the way we did that was through language. That's how important language is.
Right. I mean, people don't really think about this or remember this or even know about this, that the first few decades of the 20th century, there was a big argument in the Jewish community. Will the language of the Jews in the state of Israel, but just in general, be Hebrew or Yiddish? Hebrew ended up winning for different reasons. One of them being that Hebrew also is inclusive of the non-European Jews.
Of
which there are about half of us. But there was this big fight, and in Israel specifically, there was the killing of the old Jew, the symbolic killing of the old Jew. No one spoke Yiddish outside of the house in Israel because we are Israelis.
Yeah. They outlawed Yiddish for the most part, like Yiddish newspapers, Yiddish theater. I think... I know, like, Mike Bolstein is a big star in Israel, as is Chava Alberstein, and they both performed in Yiddish. But for the most part, they really wanted to revive a dead language. I mean, and you can actually see it. Like, when people meet Israelis, you can feel their strength, their confidence, their rootedness. It really is an amazing thing what language can do. There are other reasons why Israelis are that way, but one of the very deliberate reasons for choosing to revitalize Hebrew in our ancestral homeland is a concept that one of my friends who is a Native American activist reminded me, which was that the land speaks. And what did the land speak? Hebrew.
So this takes us to the question, why revive Yiddish? Why not perform in Hebrew?
It's a totally different flavor. It's a totally different canon of music. Although you sing Zognik Tkeinmol in Hebrew, I'm assuming it's a direct translation. Mm-hmm. I sing a song called Margarit Kalach, which is the same tune as Rakefet, if you know, in mm-hmm. Hebrew. They are wildly different lyrically. Like, one has to do with a girl who goes out and loses her virginity in the forest.
I assume that's the Yiddish one.
That's the Yiddish one. And the other is like about botany and like a rakefet, which is a daisy. It's like a totally different song. There's a lot to learn from our ancestors. We have a tradition that says, put yourself in their shoes, right? What do we say at the Seder? Live lolo. It's as if it happened to me. It's why we feel so connected to our ancestors of the past, why we feel so connected to each other, because we have a tradition of empathizing and even putting ourselves in the position of those who came before us. And that's a portal. Yiddish is one way. I mean, there's a lot to learn from our ancestors who lived in the diaspora before us, who withstood quite a lot of hardship and also maintained their joy and their humor and their sexiness. I mean, it's kind of amazing. And I do think that it helps me root myself in who I am and in the pride of who I am. And when people hear it, they like it. That's also another reason they just like it. That's important.
Yeah. So how does that feel? You know, that moment before you start the first song in a show, you stand on stage, you're in New York City or in Cleveland, Ohio, yeah, or in LA or wherever you're performing. You take that breath in and Yiddish comes out.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
I wasn't trained as a singer. So for me, it's strange because I sang at Shabbat, you know, dinner with my father, who also has a beautiful voice, but like for family, you know. I don't have the confidence that I do when I stand up and I like, I don't know, do a monologue or I'm the host of a podcast, you know. I rely very much on a spirit that moves me. It's really a very spiritual experience for me. I think part of the reason why I felt comfortable leaving orthodoxy is because I have art, which is something that really connects me to my creator, and not just my creator, but my, like I say, my ancestors, those who came before me. And when I inhale that ruach, that spirit, that breath, before I sing, I really allow myself to be a channel for those who came before me and for those who are watching me now and hopefully those who will watch, let's say, my movie generations from now.
So
not to be so hoity-toity.
No, I think that's great. And I think the generational piece is extremely important. So let's talk about Oma.
Oma! Okay.
I mean, that's another way that you've channeled the generational piece, I believe. What is Oma?
Oma is a short film that I directed about my grandmother. It was more inspired by my grandmother, but the truth is my grandparents survived the Holocaust, but they didn't tell us their story of survival. And I knew that being a third-generation Holocaust survivor, they always told us there were Holocaust deniers in the world. I mean, there were, you know, October 7th deniers on October 8th. It didn't happen, but also let it happen again, which we can just leave there for another episode of this amazing podcast. But that happened with the Holocaust as well. And so I knew there was a responsibility that I had to tell their story. Before my grandmother died, I tried to get it from her. Get it? I tried to get it. I tried so hard and she just wouldn't let go.
She wouldn't tell you what happened?
No, it was too painful for her. I knew that she was married before and that her husband died. But her mother died in the ghetto of tuberculosis at the age of 47. And she was a young girl and those nightmares never left her. And my grandfather, like I said, he was a quiet man, but he was also, you know, only really spoke Yiddish and he just couldn't. I remember there were a couple things that they would tell me, like I brought home a pad of paper that was in the shape of a star and it was yellow and he put it up to his chest and he goes, you know, I had to wear this. And I knew exactly what he was talking about. And in order to protect him, I, at 9 years old, changed the subject. There was an ethos in my family that it was too much for them to bear. But that means that the trauma can't cycle through. Like there's a reason why like talk therapy works. It's because if you don't know what's so painful and like this like dark cloud looming over you, there's a holding of your breath that happens in the ecosystem of the family. And that happens to people whose traumas are sort of kept close to them. And that PTSD can be transferred one generation to the next, which was the case for me. My father also served in the Yom Kippur War and really suffered because
of it. Yom Kippur War is 1973 war.
Yeah. But I felt that epigenetic inheritance, that feeling of dis-ease. I struggled with my health at a young age, and I knew that it had something to do with this legacy. And I wanted to tell their story, but I couldn't figure out what the story was. So I had to make it up, essentially, based on, you know, my intuition and artistic license. But that's what Oma is based on. It's a 10-minute film. It's on Prime. I did it, I don't know, more than 10 years ago now. And it healed so much in me, physically. Wild. We hold so much. It's part of the reason why we tell stories as Jews.
Did your grandparents get to see
the
film?
No, they didn't.
They chose not to, or?
By the time my grandmother could see it, she was already too old and too frail, and she knew that it was being made. But she just wanted it to be in the past, you know? Mm-hmm. I think something that I came to in that realization was like, that's her story. That's her life, you know? It affected me, affected my parents. It affects generations when we hold these things in, but it's hers.
And you are also a parent of two young children.
Yeah.
Do you feel that it still affects them as well? Is the, you know, the trauma gets watered down every generation, or has it gotten to a point where, okay,
we did it, we healed it. Something that I learned recently is that a lot of this is not in our head as Jews. Like, there are real stressful things going on in our environment that cause this neurosis. And I'm not sure that, like, the therapy world has caught up to that. Like, I think there's, like, a lot of talk about, like, you have to heal your generational line. And that's true. And I do think storytelling is very helpful. It's part of the reason why I have my podcast, Mom Curious. I think a lot of my work as a singer, it really just helps me. And it has helped our lineage as Jewish people, that we sing. I mean, that's how we pray. We sing. That's how we celebrate. We sing and we dance. I mean, it really moves the trauma through us. But that trauma is real. It is so real. That violence that we experience is so real. So to the best of my ability, am I holding on to the pain of the Holocaust or the Yom Kippur War on behalf of my parents and grandparents? No. But there are real serious things happening right now that we as parents and our children are experiencing that will inevitably impact their mental health and well-being.
So how do you I'm searching for the right words.
What here. Do we do?
Well, specifically as a parent to young children, how do you moderate it for them or mediate it for them?
And yeah.
Do you do it through song? You do it in Hebrew, in Yiddish, in English? How do you take this very scary, real world and package it for younger children in a way that they're aware that it exists, but also not overwhelmed by it?
I have to say that Jewish mothers are fucking brilliant. If I may.
You may, of course.
I gotta say, so many of like the motherhood parenting world is populated like by Jewish luminaries. And we take mothering so seriously. And I've learned, you know, through that field of study that you have to meet your kid wherever they're at, you know, where they are intellectually, but also their age. And the more we know our children, the best we can do to meet the moment. Last summer, my son asked Alexa, Alexa, what's the Holocaust? And I wait. And he goes, Alexa, what's the Yom Kippur War? And I like Boston. And I was like, I think we should talk. I wish he had asked me. But he had heard it in camp. He goes to a Jewish camp. He goes to a public school during the year. But, like, you know, I guess they were talking about it pretty, like, fluidly in camp. And he just, like, didn't know. And he didn't know that, like, his own family had been involved in those, you know, major world events, wars. And so we talked about it. So we talked about it to the best of our ability. Like, he knows who Hitler is. And he's a bad guy. He's, you know, my son is 8, so he's a bad guy, will suffice. He's probably, like, the worst guy ever.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah.
We take it one step at a time.
And so it's not just that you think about it as a mom. You think about it as a podcaster. About, you have your podcast, Mom Curious.
Yeah.
What is the podcast about? How did it start?
Oh, I started Mom Curious after I had my daughter. And I realized, like, oh, there are so many ways to be a mother. And also there are so many ways to get to motherhood that people don't talk about enough, you know? So I get to profile people who choose to be single mothers. Let's say they didn't meet their partner. I have one person in mind who told me that, you know, she just didn't meet anyone and wanted to be a mother. And so she went off and decided to be a single mother. And she told us her experience. I have another guest who had breast cancer, was infertile. She had 2 embryos on ice after meeting the love of her life. One of them did not, you know, go. And the other is 18 months old now, after she had a mastectomy and a hysterectomy. That child was born via surrogacy. There are other stories, like, you know, of IVF. There are stories of, you know, women who decide to get their MBA and then be stay-at-home mothers. My life's mission, as I understand it, is to create a little more harmony in this world. And I found that even within women and even within mothers, there is this competitive dog-eat-dog culture. And if I can put a little bit more empathy, goodness, understanding out into the world, then I've done my part.
Have you noticed in your conversations some patterns or trends about Jewish motherhood that are unique?
Probably that Jewish mothers take motherhood seriously, like I said. And I will say that in America, we represent quite a diverse population, even within the Jewish community. I mean, I have mothers on my show who have trans kids. I have mothers on my show who are Orthodox. I have mothers on my show of all political leanings who are Jewish. And I find that fascinating, that, like, we say that we're not a monolith and that we don't look all the same and we don't think all the same. But really, when you sit down, I'm sure you experience this as a podcaster yourself, you're like,
the whole point of this podcast is showing the immense diversity of thought, not just of, and of course of identity, but not just of skin color or, you know, genitals, but, like,
yeah,
who are you inside? And we're so uniquely different.
Yeah. I think Jewish mothers represent that for sure. Like, wow, there are so many different kinds of Jews. And also, probably the thing that is bonding us the most now is that we fear for our children's life and for their future in America and in Israel. I was just in France, and one of the participants of this Jewish-American-French Coalition Against Anti-Semitism, one of the participants was also a mother, and she was the one person to say out loud, where do we go? When, not if, but when it gets unlivable here. And that is a uniquely Jewish mother experience today. I don't know any other subset of mothers who are really considering their child's physical safety in the same way that we are.
I think it probably resembles, with many differences, the experience of mothers of Black kids in America.
Yeah.
Having that conversation that, you know, when you meet the police, here's how you act to save your life.
And you know that there's a huge issue with maternal mortality, like Black women dying in childbirth because of medical racism. We do share that. You know,
but also we have very differences.
And they're different. And when I try to bridge that gap on my show, you can hear it on air, actually. Not everyone wants to hear that we're the same in that way because we come at it from such different places.
Right. I mean, I think it's a human nature to think that our woes are ours uniquely.
Yeah.
And of course, there's some unique aspects to every prejudice, but also we suffer similarly as humans,
yeah,
parents, as moms. Have you noticed your parenting or parenting styles with you in your interviews having changed since the October 7th
yes.
massacre?
Yes. Yes. Shai, you're so good at this. I got a giggle in studio. He's so good at this, guys.
I'm having conversation. I'm good at conversations.
You're doing it, dude. Wow. Yeah, it has a lot. I think when we watched you and the shit show going on in Colombia, we were like, many of us were like, oh, how do we make sure that our kids don't end up like that? And there has been a huge push, an overcorrection in the parenting sphere around gentle parenting. And that gentle parenting looked a lot like permissive parenting. And I think when we really thread the needle, it can result in, you know, kids not being able to emotionally regulate, to think logically, and, you know, to organize around things that are heinous, really. That's what I witnessed, you know, from afar at Columbia. These are 18-year-olds, right? So they've left their homes and their parents did their jobs. And I thought to myself as a parent, like, how can I make sure that my kid organizes around the sanctity of life, around peace, real actual peace, that they don't fall prey to propaganda and to learning things on TikTok? You know, how do I safeguard them? And I did sort of notice that many of my guests and myself sort of inched a little bit more to the center, or even center right, actually, politically and otherwise, when it came to parenting. Like, oh, kids need structure, they need rules, they need expectations, they need no. They need to practice being really mad at home so that it doesn't look like that on the streets of New York.
Interesting. So I love this idea that, you know, what you're suggesting is that they have this anger that they don't know how to deal with, or this ennui that they don't know how to deal with, and then somehow it comes out in college campuses.
Well, I mean, the pandemic had a lot to do with, I think, a lot of this brain rot that we're watching. But it's definitely brain rot. Like, these students are exhibiting signs of real rage. And I think you know, I was a college student, and in fact, I even was on the picket line, you know, SAG-AFTRA had a strike, and I was like, you know, yelling and screaming and dancing and whatever. But I wasn't lighting things on fire. I wasn't calling for the death or annihilation of any one group, you know.
Or any individual.
Literally not one person.
Yeah.
Not one person. Yeah. That I think their parents must be so embarrassed. And if not, they ought to be.
I spent a lot of time thinking about the parents of these college students.
Right.
And what would they say? Not so much for their defense, but just what would they say if they were sitting in that chair and I was asking them, like, are you proud? Or what are you proud? Because everyone's proud of their kid, but what are you proud? Would you have done things differently? I can't imagine that they're getting this at home.
They might be.
They might be, of course. I've been proven naive multiple times.
Yeah, I am also learning that they might be. Mm-hmm. And that those college kids at NYU who had already been anti-Semitic inside my apartment telling me that we should be driven into the sea, they got it from someone. That was not in the zeitgeist then. They got that from home. And those people are adults now.
And they're the parents now.
And they're the parents.
Right.
So, and I also, I live in a very progressive part of town. And I see that parents my age, so in their 40s, 30s and 40s, are vehemently anti-Israel. Some of them are Jewish. I gotta say it out loud. It's embarrassing, but it's true. Many of them are Jewish, vehemently anti-Israel. And Hamasniks. That's me being silly.
Some of them are. Some of them are. Not, maybe without knowing that they are. You know, they think it's just a chance, just a sign, just a slogan, just a, you know, support this policy or that policy. But, you know, it's like pieces in a puzzle, and the puzzle spells out terrorism, you know, and they might not even be knowing what puzzle they're building or constructing. It's tough.
Or they might.
So let's veer back to positive.
Okay.
Do you teach your kids Yiddish?
I sing to them in Yiddish. Yeah, but I don't teach them Yiddish. I speak mostly, if I'm going to speak Yiddish, I'm going to speak to Holocaust survivors because it makes them so happy. But most people don't speak Yiddish that I know of. The ultra-Orthodox community does, actually. In Geula, where my father grew up, next to Mea Shearim, they do speak Yiddish. And Dan and I, like, got lost one day driving around trying to, like, you know, return the rental car. He only speaks English. Like, he barely speaks Hebrew. And, like, we would roll down the window and try to talk to the people on the street. And, like, I'd be like, in Hebrew I'd speak, in Yiddish. And no one would talk to me. No one. They didn't understand him. So I don't have really Yiddish-speaking buddies. I sing in Yiddish professionally, and I sometimes get to speak a little bit of Yiddish, but I don't speak to my kids. I speak to them in Hebrew.
Speak to them in Hebrew?
Little, yeah. I try.
And you gave him Hebrew names.
Great Hebrew names.
Great Hebrew names. Yeah,
thanks.
I do have a question, something that I prepare for these interviews.
Yeah, I see.
I do my homework.
You're so studious.
And I do have a question. I hope it's not too out of left field, but what is or what was Rachel and Leah in
New
Musical?
Wow. Shy Davidai. Here I am. What kind of research have you been doing?
I prepare for this.
Wow.
But I saw this. I saw it was very just one article
in an Israeli newspaper
about this, and I really was fascinated by the idea. You wrote a musical with you co-wrote with a friend from NYU, a musical about the relationship between Rachel and Leah. Rachel and Leah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. It was beautiful, actually. And it was composed by Liz Suedos, who was a Tony Award-winning composer for a brilliant play called Runaways on Broadway. And she was so cool. She passed away. But we did a bunch of workshops of it, and it didn't end up going anywhere, but it was sort of like a prequel to Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. I think what you're pointing to is that I find a lot of inspiration in the Jewish canon and in the Jewish experience. And I also, if I am looking back, that idea of sisterhood is always very present in my work. I often work with mothers and with women, but I long for a world where our differences can be celebrated and we can love each other the way we ought to be loved. Mm-hmm. That was the story of Rachel and Leah. It was so beautiful. I mean, they were so at odds with each other, and yet they risked everything to make each other happy. Rachel dies in Leah's arms. Like, that was the, like, I'm crying just thinking about it. That was the love story. It was so beautiful.
It's such a complicated story.
I know.
In fact, I was just in France as well in my cousin's wedding, and the rabbi said something about how the groom has to identify the bride before they cover her with the veil, because the last time that the groom did not identify the bride, he married her sister.
And you know what? That's where we all come from. We come from that sister. Like they say, you know, in art, when you're painting and you make a mistake, like maybe it's not a mistake, maybe it's like the most beautiful part of the picture. And it was an oopsies on the part of Jacob, I guess. Like, he probably should have checked.
Yeah.
But that's where Am Yisrael comes from. Like, we mostly come from Leah's children. And there's a reason for everything. And also, by the way, part of that musical was so interesting to do because we have these very indigenous practices that, like, the audience looks so strange, mm-hmm. like checking to make sure that the bride is actually the bride, or like we had a whole scene about the wedding, and they would go around, the bride goes around the groom seven times. And
which we still do in ultra-Orthodox weddings.
Not ultra-Orthodox, just regular weddings.
Well, I guess weddings. In some.
You gotta hang out at more it. American weddings.
Maybe. People should start inviting me.
That's an invitation to invite. Yeah. Try, in case you're wondering.
Before we end, I do have a question. If you, given...
You have questions?
I have a lot of questions, but I do have a question about parenting. Mm. Given everything that you have learned and talked with people about in the past, especially in the year and a half, but even before that, what are two or three tips for raising strong Jewish children?
You got to infuse them with joy, with the love of Judaism. It's such a fun culture and such a fun religion, actually. And I think, like, sometimes we can get a little bit weird about religion. Certainly, like, Israeli Jews are like, ugh, you know. And Americans are we're, like, pluralistic to begin with. Like, we're just not that into talking about God. Like, we call our creator or the source or whatever. But the religion itself is beautiful. Like, it really is. Even if you don't practice it, to expose your children to how Judaism manifested for centuries, for millennia, how it's still practiced by ultra-Orthodox and Orthodox Jews, how it's practiced by conservative Jews. Like, if you can, like, if you can instill the curiosity that clearly you have and I have about Judaism into our kids, like we go to France and we go visit the Chabad, you know, like we go to Portugal, we go to like the sites of our Sephardic ancestors who lived there. And we like, if we can like show them how juicy and fun and interesting it is, like that goes a long way. But I will say that you gotta educate your children about certainly what it is to be a Jew, and also Israel. You have to. Like, it is really important for them to be at that party at NYU and to be able to stand on their own two feet and say, you can't drive me out into the sea. That's, first of all, genocidal. They've tried that before. Not going to happen. Why don't we come together and figure out a solution if you're so passionate about this, right? Like all of those student leaders that on your campus, I mean, I'm so in awe of them. And their parents took them to Israel. Their parents presumably had honest conversations with them about Israel, which is not a perfect country. Doesn't have to be. But we need to know the ins and outs, and so do our children. Mm. And then the third is, if you enjoy them, like enjoy them, they feel like here I am and my existence is a delicious, amazing treat. Because like the way a parent gazes at their child, it imprints on their soul and their psyche forever. So to the best of your ability, I know it's a stressful time, but enjoy your children.
So joy, education, and enjoy your children.
For you to enjoy them. Yeah.
I think those are great tips. Well, we not only we can keep talking for hours, we have, but you know, every good thing comes to an end. And we end with the Here I Am lightning round.
Oh, right. I forgot this part.
Yes.
How could I forget?
A series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer. Just the first thing that comes to mind. And I'm pretty sure you've done your homework, so you know what's coming up. But Daniela Rabbani, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I'm such an oversharer. I feel like everyone knows everything about me. They don't know that much about Dan, actually. They don't know about my husband, and I'm gonna keep it that way.
Okay. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
They don't know anything, Shai. They don't know anything about us. I think most people don't even think about us, but those who, like, most people don't know anything about the Jewish people.
So we gotta keep teaching them.
Yeah.
What is your favorite curse?
Fuck.
What's your favorite curse in Yiddish?
What's the one? You gotta give me a second. Well, you can call someone like a shmegegi or a shmendrick or a shlemiel or a shlemazel. Those are just like mean names. there's one curse where it goes like, you should grow like an onion with your head in the sand and your feet dangling out, something like that. I'll find it and I'll send it to you somewhere.
When was the last time you cried?
I cried talking about Rachel and Leah, but then I also cried on the way here. My friend Jonah Platt, who also has a beautiful Jewish podcast, did a whole tribute to Jewish women. And I was like, it's so true. We're the beating heart of this thing. when am I not crying is really the question.
I've seen you cry quite a bit. If you could have any Jewish person.
I used to cry at Yonatan's classes. I was so moved. I was like, this is it. We're on the kibbutz all together.
I used to cry because sometimes it went on for too long, but that's my sinister me. If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Moshe Rabbeinu. how did it feel to like work that hard and then like not enjoy the fruits of your labor? Like he just didn't get there in the end.
Sounds like a typical mom.
Oh yeah. I'm like, what's wrong with you, man? Everything okay?
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Sukkot is coming to mind, not because I like it, but mostly because I'm like, why are we in huts? You know?
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
All the fasting. I don't fast anymore anyway, but I just, on principle, I'm like, we've been through enough.
When do you feel safest?
When do I feel safest? I guess at home with my children and my husband. Yeah.
When do you feel least safe?
Ugh. I actually, I don't want to make anyone feel weird. I feel so sad that, like, I went to a Jewish event yesterday and there was, like, this really cute little police officer, like, all geared up with a machine gun. And I was like, ugh. I'm happy and I'm grateful. And I always say thank you to the guards and to the police officers. But it reminds me that I'm actually not safe.
What gives you hope?
Conversations like this.
We should have more conversations.
Look, please, God, more conversations. Can the Jews all get together? No cameras, no mics, nothing. Like, all of us. Just like the Jewish leaders. Can we all get together and just talk? Even if we disagree, can we do that?
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
AJC, the American Jewish Committee. They do the most humble, amazing, quiet work. They're not here for the applause. They're just doing tremendous advocacy for the hostages, for diaspora Jews. I have fallen in love with AJC, and I think if you check them out, you will too.
Daniela, where can people find you?
You can find me at Daniela Rabbani on Instagram.
Where can they find your podcast?
You can find Mom Curious on all streaming platforms.
And I should also ask, where can they find your upcoming debut album, Klezmeret?
Klezmeret will probably also be on Apple and Spotify. If this comes out before June 30th, you can see me at Summer Stage. It won't. But that's okay.
Now you can have FOMO.
Okay, so you can have FOMO. That like thousands of people singing in Yiddish all together in Central Park. That's coming up pretty soon. But yeah.
Well, this has been a true joy. And I'm just glad to say, here I am with Daniela Rabbani.
Thank you, Shai.
Now, stay there. Because I do also want to ask you if you'd be willing to sing for us in Yiddish.
In Yiddish?
Yes.
What should I sing? Do you want me to sing Zoknitz Kedmol?
It's
not the prettiest song.
What did you sing in Lodz?
Lodz Mazel?
Oh, you sang Mazel?
I sang a bunch of Holocaust songs that were written and performed in the Holocaust. That's how sacred this art is to the Jews. Performance.
I would love to hear one of those.
Yeah. There's a song called Zol Shoin Kamindi Geula. I'll give you the chorus. It says, soon there will be redemption. Zol Shoin Kamindi Geula. Mashiach Kum Shoin Bald. Of course, if you believe in Mashiach, then Aderabet. That sounds great fun. But a solution, let's say, will come soon. And I think it's a nice message, and it's a message that the Jews have been saying for such a long time, like, one day all of this will make sense. One day we'll have peace. One day, one day, one day. And sometimes those days do come, so. Zol shoin kumen di geule, zol shoin kumen di geule, zol shoin kumen di geule, Mashiach kum shoin bald, zol shoin kumen di geule, zol shoin kumen di geule, zol shoin kumen di geule, Mashiach kum shoin bald. Is that that all I have to say? Yeah, I think that's all. I didn't give you the verse, but.
Wow. I love it.
Thank you.
I love it.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."